irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, I will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, today, in our current fast-paced culture of high stress and hard work, where we're constantly scrambling to compete, climb the career ladder, juggle the demands of work and family, and somehow maintain our mental health and sanity all at the same time, that's a tall order. Well, to discuss how to best deal with these stressors and more, our guest today, Dr. Sheeny Ambrador, is a top-rated and award-winning physician specializing in adult psychiatry with an expertise in pharmacologic medication management as well as psychotherapy. Dr. Ambrador graduated with honors in biological sciences from Stanford and completed medical school at Baylor College of Medicine. She completed her adult psychiatry residency training at St. Vincent's Hospital Medical College. Dr. Ambrador has worked for Kaiser Permanente in Southern California as a full-time attending physician. And in 2010, 11, 12, and 13, Dr. Ambrador was awarded the Compassionate Doctor Award and is identified as one of America's most compassionate doctors. She is also a writer and contributor to the Huffington Post, where she writes about a variety of topics related to happiness, mental health, psychology, and psychiatry. Dr. Ambrador, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I had a chance to go to your website and to take a look at a lot of the things that you're doing, and I really believe that you're grasping the idea of happiness and really helping people to direct them to something that is working directly for them, you know, something that is very specific to them, because obviously it's not something that is one answer fits all. So
exactly.
So I like the way that you approach it. Now, one of the things that I saw in there was the way in which you defined happiness. So share with our audience, how do you define happiness?
Well, you know, I think it's a very personal thing, and I'm sure that everyone has their own personal definition of what happiness means to them. To me personally, it's just a feeling of peace and contentedness. I think our minds, kind of all the thoughts we have on our minds, if we can learn to master our minds, that would kind of take us towards happiness. So, you know, we always have all these thoughts swirling in our heads, and if we can learn to master those thoughts, I think that will foster a sense of peace, and that in turn will lead to inner happiness. So I think it's more an internal state.
So now, what was going through your mind when it was time? I mean, all of us, when we open up a business, we sit down and we think, okay, what am I going to name my company? And I know that when I did this over 30 years ago, and I sat down and I talked to different friends and said, well, what do you think of this? And how does this fit? And based on the message that I want, what did you go through when you decided to name your practice the Happiness Psychiatrist?
Well, you know, I really wanted to put a positive spin on psychiatry. I think psychiatrists and psychiatry, there's kind of this weird negative stigma around mental health and seeking help from a psychiatrist. So I really wanted to change that perception in the public mind, at least. And that's why I named my practice the Happiness Psychiatrist. In addition, I just like to focus on the brighter side of life. So obviously, you know, every day I'm dealing with things like depression and anxiety, which aren't the most pleasant emotions, but I always like to try to put a positive spin on things. And in addition to prescribing medication, talk about how the patient themselves can take a more proactive approach to bringing happiness into their lives. So that was kind of my main reason for choosing the term happiness psychiatrist, because I wanted to shift people's attention towards more positive mental states like happiness, mindfulness, and inner peace.
Now, you just mentioned medication. That's a topic that there are people out there that are incredibly for it. There are people out there that are incredibly against it. What are your thoughts about psychiatric medications and how you use them?
Well, you know, I think as with everything else in life, I think, yes, if you approach it kind of in a balanced way, then they can be very helpful. So, you know, I do believe in psychiatric medications and I use them every day to treat patients. But I try to take a measured kind of holistic approach. So obviously using medications is one kind of tool that we have. And then we have all these other tools that we can also use. So I definitely think medications work and they're very helpful to patients in need, patients who are struggling with their mood and their mental health. So I think they have their place. But then I think you can supplement the medications with lots of other kind of behavioral changes as well.
Now, we work with a lot of at-risk youth, and there have been many cases where part of our job was to transport a particular child to and from their psychiatrist. And is one of the things that you do, or one of the things that I noticed with some, is if they've gotten to a point to where they are taking a cocktail of eight different medications, sometimes is it better to sort of, you know, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, how do you handle that? Do you wean them off of it from the standpoint of knowing which ones they should stay on, which ones need to come off? How do you get them to a point that you feel comfortable with which ones they're on and how they're performing for them?
So, you know, essentially, I think it's important to build a rapport with the patient and to really take the time to get a sense for what they're really struggling with and what their daily symptoms are, what their symptomatology is. So once you can get a true feel for what exactly their issues are, I think then you can, you know, as an experienced psychiatrist, you can start to figure out, okay, maybe we can slowly wean off of this medication. Maybe we should just focus on this other medication. So, you know, eight medications is a lot of medications for one person to be on. So, you know, I tend to, obviously with the patient's consent, try to taper down some of those I would do. But once again, it's about building a rapport with the patient and only doing it at the pace that the patient is comfortable with. So,
well, and that makes perfect sense. And I would imagine that it can be extremely harmful in those situations to where the patient just decides to cut them all off all at once.
Right, right. And then obviously, you know, hopefully the patient would have a good relationship with a psychiatrist that they trusted, and they would be able to tell the psychiatrist openly, you know, like, I'm frustrated and I'm thinking of just stopping my medications completely, which actually, you know, is very common. That's a common feeling that a lot of patients have. A lot of times they do get frustrated and they want to just stop everything. So hopefully if you have a good rapport with the patient, they're honest with you and they tell you that, and then you can kind of work with them to say, okay, I understand that, and maybe we can taper down this one a little bit faster, but let's stay on this one for maybe another couple weeks. So it's really a matter of just listening to the patient and kind of being there with them as they go on their journey.
Right. And what I hear you saying is you're taking the time to establish the rapport and gaining the trust. If that person mm-hmm. trusts you at that point, they're going to listen to your advice. That makes perfect sense.
Exactly, right.
Now, you mentioned earlier just some of the other modalities. Share with us some of the other modalities that are useful in your practice.
So, you know, when I started my practice, I really wanted to take a holistic approach to mental health. So in addition to medications, I do psychotherapy. I also kind of incorporate Eastern philosophies and Eastern techniques into my practice. So meditation, Kundalini yoga. I also do walking therapy, which I'm very proud of. I think I'm maybe, you know, the only medical doctor in California who does that with their patients. So, and I also do journal therapy. So I wanted to kind of really approach mental health holistically. And I kind of, obviously I go based on what the patient is interested in. Some patients are interested in walking therapy. Others are not interested in it, which is fine. Some patients are very open to meditating a little bit during our session. Some patients are not. So it's kind of what the patient is open to, but I like to offer that and I like to make it known that I take a very holistic approach.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I visualized, walking therapy, and the initial visualization I had was you're prescribing somebody, you know, walk 3 miles a day. And then it dawned on me, I think what you're talking about is that you're actually walking with them.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are lots of kind of parks around my office area, and I'm happy to meet patients either nearby or sometimes they go a little bit further and we walk for the full hour session. So instead of just sitting in the office and talking, which is also very helpful, we actually walk and talk at the same time. And yeah, a lot of patients, they do enjoy that. You know, you're outside, you're getting a little bit of exercise, and you're talking to your therapist. So
that's great. They're multitasking.
Exactly. Yeah.
So now I know that I read the article that you did that was in the Huffington Post, and one of the things that you touched on there was, you know, 10 ways to improve, you know, depression and anxiety without meds. Can you share with us some of those points?
Yeah, so the article was actually very well received, and I was really pleased that it helped so many people. Let me just go over. So the first point actually was limit your time on Facebook. And I would expand that to include kind of all social media. I think nowadays we are so distracted by the internet and by social media, and I think it's really doing a number on our brains and our mental health. So I would strongly recommend taking like a break from your computer or your iPhone or the internet every day. You know, maybe carve out like, okay, this for 1 hour, I'm not going to check my phone or I'm not going to get on the computer. And that's really hard to do in today's day and age. But I think it's going to be vital as we move forward, you know, with even more emerging technologies. I think it's going to be vital to really just disconnect from all of that and try to kind of foster inner peace. So that was my first recommendation. And then moving on, I had all these other recommendations. Did any of them particularly stand out to you that you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, the first one was actually, that was the one, as soon as I read it and I just, this light went, that's me. Okay. So I went, okay, I'm getting something immediately from this because that becomes one of my problems. And it's not just social media, but it's just being connected to the phone, being connected to the computer, you know, whatever it may be, and realizing that it really is taking away from my peace because mm-hmm. it's pulling me away from whatever it is that I'm focused on at that point. Now, fortunately, I've started to move in the right direction. And I walk every morning in a eucalyptus park with the dogs, and don't bring my phone or turn my phone off, you know. And so I get it. So I read it, but I'm also listening. I'm taking it in myself. But I just saw that as I read it, I thought, you know, this one may fit for me. But I thought, you know, these are broken down in such a way that I think anybody that would read it would find the ones that fit them. They, you know, mm-hmm. they all may not, but certain ones certainly did. So, and in fact, you know, one of the things I want to share with the audience is that if you want to be able to, you know, to check those out or, you know, or follow along, you can open up another window. If you're at your computer, you can go to happinesspsychiatrist.com, and there's information there. There's a link that goes directly to this. And we can also make sure there's a link for those of you driving and you can't write that down. If you go to our Answers for the Family site, we will make sure that there's a link there as well so they can follow along. So what would be another one that you found that other people, that the feedback from other people has been, wow, that was one that really resonated with me?
You know, the one about spirituality has been really helpful for people, and I think spirituality is a term that maybe sometimes is misconstrued or misunderstood. And by that term, you know, I think it's a very broad term. It doesn't mean anything specifically religious. It just means connecting to kind of the bigger picture, the larger cosmos, the universe, just kind of being at one with everything in whatever way you can connect to spirituality, you know, whatever that means to you, you know, whether it's nature or meditating or taking a warm bath or reading a book in silence. You know, I find that spirituality really helps ground patients, especially when we talk about it in sessions. And everyone has their own personal take on spirituality. And as I said, whatever works for you. But really maybe take some time to cultivate a spiritual practice where you think about kind of the larger picture. And I think that helps people put their own kind of daily difficulties in perspective so that it's not as kind of stressful when you look at it from, you know, a very broad perspective.
Yeah, and it's not judging. You know, that's one of the things that I liked about the way in which you presented it in there is that it's not judging you, it's not trying to direct you in any way. It is just saying to find that place that works best for you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, and it's a very personal pursuit. And that's what I think is important and vital to happiness when you personally decide what works best for you. I think that's key to being happier.
Now, another thing I wanted to discuss with you that it has to do with measuring happiness. I am of the belief that there are ways that we can measure this, that some of the issues that we have, you know, on a bigger level, on a political level or whatever, is that we're spending all of this time trying to measure, you know, gross national product and you know, productivity and all of this, and we're not taking the time to really measure happiness. Are the decisions that are being made really focused on, you know, on all of us? You know, and we're not just trying to make two or three people happy, but we're trying to figure out a way to measure it for everybody. So I guess the question is, you know, do you feel it can be measured? And if so, how can we best do that?
Well, on a national level, you know, it's interesting that you brought up kind of the country's view of happiness. I know one country in Asia called Bhutan actually has this thing called gross national happiness.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and I think it's a great concept because they're actually, that just shows how important happiness is to them. And I think they've made a pact that they're going to limit the kind of deforestation of their country. They're going to keep some of the forests because, you know, even though they could make more money if they deforested, they think that's not their primary concern. So I think that's a really balanced way to look at things. They're like, we're going to make a conscious national intention to value happiness over material gains. And frankly, I think there would have to be a real grassroots shift in America away from materialism. And I think, you know, it can happen, but I think it's going to take a lot of time because for whatever reason, you know, we are a pretty materialistic society. So maybe if we started on an individual level where people individually started valuing happiness and the inner life and introspection, then maybe it would just kind of percolate, you know, up to the government level. But, you know, I think it starts with individuals, you know, personally in your life or in my life, let's say, how can we make our own personal happiness a priority? And I know even in my life, you know, I haven't always made happiness a priority and I didn't even know that you could do that or, you know, what that was. So it's taken me time myself to kind of figure out, you know, what is happiness for me? How can I prioritize it? And I just feel like maybe in our schools, maybe we could teach happiness skills in our schools from an early age, you know, what is really important in life. So maybe that would be a good idea, you know, starting early and teaching the topic in schools.
You know, I think you nailed it on both fronts. You know, the one of which is in the schools. Absolutely. We have to start the next generation, you know, in that focus, in starting to focus on what is happiness and what can we do to bring it to ourselves and others. But I think the other point that you touched on when you said as far as the happiness for yourself, I think one of the things that some of us get caught up in, especially those of us that are in what would be construed as a helping field, is we tend to get caught up with helping others. And we start doing that and we feel that this is our calling and this is what we're supposed to do. And then I think at some point in time, we realize that if we're going to do this successfully, we've got to back up for a minute and make sure we're still taking care of ourselves. So I think that's such a great point that you brought up, and especially for the listeners for this show, because I know that we get a lot of teachers, psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, police officers, educational consultants, you know, all people that are so focused on helping others that sometimes we forget about ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, really vital point because, you know, burnout in the helping professions is a real thing. Compassion fatigue is a real thing. And I came across this quote that said, if your compassion does not include yourself, it is incomplete. And I think that's really important. You know, compassion shouldn't just be limited to other people. You know, you should have compassion for yourself as well. So I'm definitely working on that in my own life, you know, trying to do things that are good for me. Because I, you know, my state of mental health and my happiness is just as important as, you know, anyone else's, right?
Absolutely. Now, we have a listener question that has come in that I'd like to share with you. And again, I want to thank those people that take the time, that get the press release and take the time to actually put together a question. And I appreciate the fact that usually when you do, that means you're going to listen through iTunes or Stitcher or some other means at a later time for the answer. And this one reads, I am the parent of a 16-year-old daughter with raging hormones and a temper to match. She feels that everything outside of herself, including her family, are causing her stress and causing her unhappiness. After therapy, a stack of books and a host of other tactics to turn this around, we feel, you know, we move one step forward and two steps back. What are your thoughts and recommendations about this? And it's signed Wits End in Arizona.
Okay. So, you know, that's obviously a very complicated question, probably a lot of factors going into the situation. I would maybe recommend first, and I know this might sound strange, but I would ask if the parents are in therapy. And that's just because sometimes parents themselves, you know, even though they have the best of intentions and they really want to help their children, they themselves are suffering or struggling, or there's some kind of inner conflict even with the parents, and then that's kind of reflected in the child. So maybe it would be helpful for the mother to go to therapy herself to learn ways to deal with her child. And then once she is in therapy and she feels like she's being heard and kind of cared for, maybe then she can sit with her daughter and be more present and grounded and listen to her daughter. Because oftentimes, you know, our children kind of reflect back to us maybe some of our own blind spots or some of the things that we need to work on. So that would be a recommendation. You know, maybe the mother would be open to seeing a therapist herself. And then I would just, and I know it's very hard, but I would just try to listen to the daughter, you know, try to just be empathetic and compassionate and put yourself in the daughter's shoes. But then also maybe as the parent, examine yourself and learn techniques or ways that you yourself could change or improve your own behaviors or communication style. And then I think the child kind of learns from that. So,
well, I think that's, first of all, I think it's a great suggestion. And I see it as twofold. You know, one is that yes, the parents may have to deal with some of their own issues. The second thing is that if that child has any form of stigma about going to see someone, it's then much easier for the parent who's asking them to say, you know, I'm going as well. So this is not, we're not, and oftentimes in dealing with some of the kids that we transport, they refer to what we're doing as their parents are just sending us the problem away and not dealing with it. So the fact that you went right to the parents, I think, is so important for not only the parents to hear it, but, you know, then for the child to understand that the parents are very serious.
Right, right. And I think that takes maturity on the part of the parent, you know, to kind of look within and say, okay, maybe I need to work on myself too. And I think the child would really appreciate that, you know, kind of an open dialogue. And as you said, you know, making therapy less of a stigma, you know, I think we could all benefit from therapy. So,
exactly. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. So again, for anybody out there, if you are sitting at a computer, if you want to open up another window and follow along, you can go to happinesspsychiatrist.com. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and our guest today is Dr. Sheeny Ambador, and also known as the Happiness Psychiatrist. Now, Dr. Ambador, we were talking a little bit earlier about, I mean, as far as depression and a lot of the issues that many of us are dealing with. Why do you think that there has been such an increase in depression within America when we are supposed to be the, you know, one of the, I don't want to say happiest, but at least, you know, one of the most progressive countries? We're supposed to be, you know, obviously a very wealthy country, and yet we seem to be going in the opposite direction as it relates to depression.
You know, I think it has something to do with the high emphasis that we place on the outer life and material things, you know, whether it's the constant striving for more money, a bigger house, outward beauty. So I think maybe we are valuing, and there's nothing wrong with those things, like there's nothing wrong with money or a nice house or outward beauty, but I think we just prioritize those outward things a little too much. And we forget about, you know, all the inner qualities or inner values that really foster true peace and happiness. So I think that it is maybe our preoccupation with status and image and the outer life. And, you know, studies have been done that show that, you know, after a certain point, after a certain income level, more money does not equal more happiness. So when you have more money, you may have more comfort. But comfort doesn't equal happiness. Comfort sometimes equals boredom and complacency. So I think that's really vital for people to recognize that after a certain level, you know, you can get a lot more money, but that doesn't mean you're going to be any happier or any more content with your life.
Yeah, and I think that more and more, you know, commercialism, it's starting at such an early age. You know, you look at commercials now, if you look to one of the channels that kids go to, and you realize that from a commercial standpoint, they are being told so quickly what it is they have to have, how it is they have to look, what it is they have to wear, you know, and if it's not a name brand, that they should somehow be unhappy about it. How much of this do you see as that being a huge factor?
I think it's a huge factor, and I think that's a good point that it starts really young. And I think one way that parents can maybe help mitigate this is just, and I know it's probably very hard to do, but maybe limit TV time or media time. And I know it's not an easy thing to do, but maybe parents recognize first that the media, you know, obviously with commercials, their primary goal is to sell their product, right? And then advertisers use a lot of psychological manipulation sometimes to sell products. So just being aware of that, I think, is really valuable for parents, and then maybe educating their teens about advertising or media, you know? Mm-hmm. I think just kind of going in being aware that the commercial's primary goal is to sell you something, and just be aware of that.
Yeah, and one of the things that we did along those lines was until about age five, we didn't allow the boys to watch commercial television. So we had every Disney video you could have, all of these things, to where that was already on a disc or already on a tape, and you could put that in, and you didn't have, you know, the sales of every toy or every piece of clothing and so on. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. And then, as you said, with the teens, is looking at it as a business training. So as you're watching this, what do you think they are trying to do? What is their goal in regards to this? And then let them tell you, hey, well, they're trying to sell me that. So do you think that Buzz Lightyear thing that's going through the air, do you think that really flies?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that would be a really valuable conversation. I know even when I was growing up, I was so mesmerized by commercials, and, you know, I really thought that, you know, whatever they're selling, it's really for my own benefit. And that's only when I got much older that I was like, wait, this is a business. And I wasn't aware of that. So just having that discussion with the teens, I think, would be very valuable.
So, and along those lines, what would be some other practical tips that you would want to give to parents, either, you know, for their children or even for themselves, to be able to be happier and more accepting of what it is you have versus constantly trying to believe that you're unhappy unless you get a little more?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think gratitude is a real important component of happiness. I think lots of studies have shown that practicing gratitude on a daily basis or a weekly basis really helps foster happiness and inner peace. So practically, what would that look like? A lot of patients, I recommend that they keep a daily gratitude journal where they basically just count their blessings every day or once a week, and that they really take the time to appreciate and savor all the wonderful things that are already present in their life. So, for instance, we could say just by virtue of the fact that we live in America, we have a lot to be grateful for, right? I mean, we're not living in a war-torn country. You know, we have basic amenities here. And I think maybe people forget that. You know, they lose sight of some of those more basic things. So make a list of 10 things you're grateful for and do that maybe every day, or if 10 is too much, maybe 3 things you're grateful for at the end of your day. And that really has been shown to increase happiness levels over time, because you take the time to stop and recognize that you already have so much good in your life. And then by recognizing that good, you'll pull in more good. You know, you'll have positive energy, and then that will pull in more positive things to you. So gratitude, I would say, keeping a gratitude journal, that would be a real, real important component of, you know, developing a happiness practice if you wanted to.
Okay. And one of the things that everybody on this show knows that has ever listened is I love success stories. So obviously, I know for confidentiality, you cannot give anybody's names, and we're not asking for that. But share with us some success stories where somebody was dealing with a particular issue, and tell us some of the stages that they hit where there was that aha moment in which they started making huge growth, where all of a sudden they were taking those steps to where you saw they get it, they're moving forward and really taking responsibility of their own life.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I won't provide any identifying details, but there was a patient that comes to mind who came to see me. He was very depressed, actually suicidal, and he was highly accomplished. He had actually won a quite prestigious award. So highly accomplished, had just won an award, and paradoxically, he was plunged into depression, and, you know, he was even feeling suicidal. And we kind of, you know, I saw him in weekly therapy for quite some time, and we slowly started to shift. Well, first of all, you know, we adjusted the medication regimen, so that was an important part in helping him feel better. But then we started to shift his mindset where, you know, he came in and he was quite negative. He was really kind of just focusing on the negative things in his life. And we started talking about, you know, things like positivity and gratitude. And at first I felt like, you know, he wasn't really buying it. You know, it sounds kind of Pollyanna-ish to him. But we, you know, we kept at it. And I think by the time, you know, he stopped seeing me, he had kind of shifted his mindset where he was actually looking for positive things. He went on to get out of kind of a bad relationship that he was in when he first started seeing me. He bought a new house. He got into a new relationship. You know, he started working out, exercising daily. So it was a gradual shift. But, you know, when he came to see me, he was quite negative in his outlook. And then over time, he started, I think, realizing that he could proactively take certain steps to, you know, have a more positive mindset. Another thing we worked on, which was really helpful, was his assertiveness. He tended to kind of go with the flow and not really voice his true feelings or opinions. And we worked on just helping him be more assertive in his daily life. And that really helped him kind of feel happier. So that was a success story that I had. And, you know, he really went from being depressed and suicidal to kind of having a whole new life after a year and a half.
Well, we have an email question that I think touches on that subject. This one reads, how do we stop expecting others to contribute to our happiness? It says, i.e. husband, children, parents, friends, etc.
So that's a complicated question because we are very intimately influenced by the people closest to us. There's one quote by Sri Sri Ravi Shankar that I just want to read. He said, "Nothing in the world can bother you as much as your own mind, I tell you. In fact, others seem to be bothering you, but it is not others. It is your own mind." So essentially, you know, it's our own mind that is bothering us. But that being said, obviously, we are very influenced by the people that we live with, our family members. I would say, Take stock of who the toxic people in your life are. And sometimes that's really hard. Sometimes the toxic people in our life, you know, it's our own family. And so that's not an easy situation to be in. You know, I always try to help people limit their time with toxic people. And once again, it's not something that's easy to do. Sometimes there are coworkers, we can't escape them, but whatever you can do to limit interaction with people that you've determined are truly toxic in your life would be really helpful. Just recognize that having toxic people around you does not help you. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Oh, I think it does, because I mean, essentially what I hear you saying is that, you know, it isn't necessarily what they said, but how you take it.
Yeah, it's definitely how you take it and how you process it. At the same time, I do understand it's hard, though, to live with someone who is very toxic. So, you know, at the end of the day, yes, it is how you take it and how you react. But if you can limit your time around really toxic people, that would be quite helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another email that came in. This one reads, "Happiness seems to be such an overused and elusive concept these days. What makes your approach to it different and successful?"
So I think happiness is gaining a lot of traction in the mainstream media, which I would argue is actually a good thing. And sometimes when things start to get popular, then people start to question them and say, well, is this just a fad or is this just a trend? And happiness may be a trend nowadays. You know, I'm not going to deny that it may be a fad, but I would argue that it's actually a positive trend. It's a positive fad. You know, there are so many fads and trends that are not very positive. So this is one that I think is actually quite positive. I would say that my approach is similar to a lot of the approaches out there, maybe a little different because I'm applying happiness to a scientific field like psychiatry, which historically has not really focused on happiness. So I think my approach, at least in my medical practice, is that I value the use of psychiatric medication, but then I also place a lot of heavy emphasis on our own personal behaviors, you know, and I really try to integrate Eastern philosophies into psychiatry. So I think that's how I would be a little different. You know, I'm taking a scientific approach, but then I'm also kind of blending spirituality. So, and that's kind of where I feel my kind of calling is to blend the scientific with the spiritual.
And I agree with what you said in regards to the concept of, you know, it may be a fad, but if it is a fad, it's certainly a good one, and it's something that we should keep doing. Mm-hmm. I was at a party last night, and it involved a couple of people who just came back from South America, where they rescued girls out of human trafficking. And mm-hmm. So as I'm talking to two different people there, one person says, "So, you know, this seems like this is like a new fad. All of a sudden, it's all over the media that, you know, that people are trying to focus on this. You know, is this something that, you know, that is really happening this much? You know, or is it just a fad that now everybody wants to try to help with something?" And I said, "Well, if it is a fad, isn't it something that we should stop anyway? I mean, that's the first thing. But the other part is that sometimes it's just that it's getting more exposure. You know, I know that in that subject, it's been going on for 30 years that I know of, that I've been mm-hmm. involved with it. So, yes, it's getting more media exposure. And I think that that's a great thing because that happens to be something we can stop. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is that, yeah, if happiness is a fad, great. But it's a good fad, so let's keep it going because it's a win-win situation."
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the perfect approach to it. And I'm kind of empathetic with the people that might be a little suspicious of it. Maybe they are in a place in their life where they can't really think about happiness. Maybe they feel like happiness is just this pie in the sky concept that is only available to, you know, a certain segment of the population. So I kind of understand their suspicion, but I would just, for those people, I would tell them that, you know, happiness is really important to everyone. And as I said, it doesn't depend on external things or material things. So no matter where you are in life, you know, you can start to be happier just by focusing on kind of your inner life and checking in with yourself and asking yourself, what's good for me right now? And I don't see how that's a bad thing for anyone.
And, you know, along those lines, you know, the opposite of that is sort of the doom and gloom. Talk a little bit about what appears to be sort of a doom and gloom mentality that we're getting that's really being projected out quite a bit from the media, sort of like a political agenda that if we tell people enough doom and gloom that maybe they will, believe that they need them. I don't know, but what's your thoughts on that? And how is that, do you think, affecting all of us?
I think it's probably affecting people deeply. You know, all the negativity in the media, all the media coverage of, you know, everything that's bad. You know, we don't necessarily cover the good things. So I think it's probably really increasing fear, anxiety, depression. And that's where the individual really has to recognize, number one, that, okay, bad things are happening in the world. You know, I'm aware of that. But number two, maybe the media is focusing on that, and it's my responsibility to go on a media diet and mm-hmm. recognize that I need to look after my own mental health. And a good way to do that is to choose what I focus on. So I think obviously it's important to be aware of what's going on in the world, but you don't necessarily have to focus on it 24/7, right? You can kind of say, okay, I'm aware that this happened, that sucks, but I'm going to make an effort to cultivate inner happiness and peace using my own techniques or my own methods. You know, I'm going to make a conscious choice to focus on the positive things going on. And I think that's a valid way of looking at things. I mean, the other option is just to focus on the negative, and, you know, I don't see how that's going to get you anywhere good, so.
Yep. Yeah, and I know that some of the young people that we end up working with that we're transporting to a specialized program or to a hospital setting, the things that they talk about, you know, when we would, you know, if they're talking about why they, let's say that they, it might be somebody who attempted to commit suicide, why did they do that? And And they talk about it from the standpoint of, why not? I'm not going to live that long anyway. You know, the world is going to be destroyed. It's either going to be destroyed because of global warming, or somebody's going to nuke us, or there's going to be a terrorist attack and we're going to be blown up. You know, it's all of these things that they're worried about that they shouldn't have to worry about this stuff. I mean, you know, just, you know, worry about, you know, going to school and making friends and going home to your family, not some this doom and gloom that seems to be just pushed on them, 24/7.
Yeah, I agree. And then if the teen is in that kind of situation, you know, they would need a heavy dose of positivity infused into their life, or spirituality to kind of counteract all that negativity. And that's kind of a daunting task for parents. You know, I know it's hard to be a parent because you have to kind of counteract all the negative messages, and it's tough, yeah.
Now, and I just glanced over, and we've got just a few minutes. What do you have coming up? Are there any seminars coming up, or anything that's coming up that you want to share with the listeners at this point?
I may be giving a free workshop in Santa Monica towards the middle or the end of December. I haven't actually decided on a date yet, but it'll probably be at the Santa Monica Public Library. But, you know, I can't give out a date yet because I haven't solidified the date. But, yeah, there will hopefully be a free workshop on happiness in the real world.
Okay. And again, for everybody out there, I would imagine that'll be posted either at happinesspsychiatrist.com.
You can come to my website, and I'll post the date on there when I finalize the date.
There you go. And if you can share with us, I mean, one more success story that we can end the show with, to where everybody kind of leaves with a sense of calm and a sense of belief that all is good out there.
Okay, let's see. So I had a female patient in her 20s come in, and she was kind of very depressed and anxious after a romantic breakup. And we kind of, you know, once again, I saw her weekly for therapy as well, and we kind of got into how this situation had been created, how this romantic dynamic had been created with her ex-boyfriend. And what we realized is that she, too, as my other patient I mentioned, she, too, had not been assertive. She hadn't been kind of clear about her needs. She didn't kind of speak up for herself and value her own needs. She was kind of going with the flow and just trying to, you know, please the partner. And so very slowly I helped her change her mindset to where I said, you know, you're the most important person in your life, and everyone else is kind of secondary, including, you know, your boyfriend or your ex-boyfriend, and you'll be much happier and your future partner will respect you a lot more if you come from a place of, you know, inner strength and confidence and really learn to value yourself. And, you know, she's a beautiful young woman. And oftentimes, you know, I have patients who are, let's say, very physically attractive, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they recognize their true inner worth. So I really just helped her recognize how valuable she was and how her thoughts and opinions and desires mattered. And gradually over time, you know, I think she has gotten a lot stronger, and she has distanced herself from kind of negative ex-boyfriends. And she's, you know, now she's dating, and she's approaching dating from a place of strength. So that would be another success story.
And do you also have situations where you're working with a couple? So they both come to you and say, you know, we're having a disconnect. What can we do to reconnect, and hopefully, you know, re-achieve the love that we were feeling just 6 months ago?
Yeah, I have couples that come see me as well. I mean, mainly I see individuals, but I have had couples come see me, and that's a whole different dynamic, you know, in the therapy room. But yeah, you know, I have helped people kind of see their partner's point of view, and I think it's a matter of just listening to each other and trying to be empathetic, really putting yourself in the other person's shoes and realizing that your partner is, obviously, they're with you, so they're not out to get you, you know, they're not out to hurt you, at least not purposely. And so trying to ask yourself, where could they be coming from? You know, where are they hurting? know, if they're angry, what is the hurt behind all that anger? So it's kind of, it helps kind of helping couples be empathetic with each other.
Well, Dr. Ambedar, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. This is a breath of fresh air to be able to go on the air and to talk about happiness and to know that there are more people like yourself that are out there really projecting this type of happiness for everybody and knowing that it is available to all of us. So thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it, and I look forward to I'd love to meet you in person and come to one of the seminars and hear more information.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, I loved being on, and I love talking about this topic. You know, this is a topic near and dear to my heart, so I'm really glad I was able to chat with you and share the information.
That sounds great. Well, have a great week, and for everybody out there, be good humans, and be with us again next week, and listen to Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.